Good day. You are listening to today's edition of the BBC. Today's date is May 27th, 2026, and my name is Les. The first article today, Ebola hit DR Congo faces quote-unquote catastrophic collision of disease and conflict, who warns, by Dan Sales. Ongoing conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo is hampering the Ebola outbreak response, the head of the World Health Organization, or WHO, has warned. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the east of the country was at the center of a quote-unquote catastrophic collision of disease and conflict, with the Ebola outbreak in Ituri province outpacing the response. In a statement posted on X, Tedros said the WHO, quote, cannot build community trust or isolate the sick while bombs are falling, end quote. He is due to arrive in DR Congo on Wednesday to spearhead scaling up efforts to contain the virus. There have been 220 suspected deaths since the outbreak was declared. Aid workers have been struggling as travel is difficult because of poor road conditions, while conflict and mass displacement have also weakened the health system, as have international aid cuts. Ituri, where most of the cases have been reported, has been under military rule since 2021, when the civilian authority was replaced by a military general in an attempt to neutralize dozens of armed groups that operate there. Tedros said stopping transmission in the region, quote, depends entirely on humanitarian access, end quote. He went on to say, yet ongoing clashes are driving mass displacement, pushing exposed contacts into overcrowded camps, and severing critical containment corridors. Frontline workers are risking everything, while attacks on health facilities make tracking cases and their contacts nearly impossible. He called on all parties to agree to an immediate ceasefire to allow medical teams safe access. Concerns over the possible spread of the Ebola outbreak has spurred more countries into imposing strict travel restrictions. Canada has announced a temporary 90-day entry ban on residents from DR Congo and neighboring Uganda and South Sudan. The Bahamas also imposed strict rules meaning foreign nationals from those countries face quarantine or isolation measures. Last week, the U.S. banned non-citizens who had traveled to the three places from entering. The Congolese health authorities say around 1,000 people are currently showing symptoms consistent with Ebola. The DR Congo country director for the medical charity Medecins Sans Frontieres, or MSF, has told the BBC it will take several weeks to get proper infrastructure in place to contain the outbreak. This outbreak is a rare species of Ebola, known as Bundibugyo, for which there are no vaccines or medicines. DR Congo health authorities have been struggling to confirm cases of the 220 deaths. Only 17 people so far have been confirmed by lab tests as having died from the disease. Medics are also facing a race against time to trace 3,600 people identified as contacts of the infected group. Some 2,000 tests have been distributed, with a further 4,000 due to be sent out. Experimental treatments, including an antibody developed in the U.S., could also be introduced soon. Ewald Stahls, MSF director in DR Congo, said the medical charity and other organizations were working to get medical supplies and workers into the epicenter of the crisis, but insecurity and poor transport links in Ituri province made it difficult. Slowly but surely, there is, of course, some activity going on, but overall, we're still far behind having a control on the situation, so we still do not have a full picture of what is happening, and that is mainly likely due to insufficient testing, he told the BBC. He went on to say, so we need more testing, we need more diagnosis to make sure that we get a full picture of what is going on. So we do not have that for the moment. And as long as that is the case, we kind of can say that we're running behind the virus, that the virus is still ahead of us and that we really have to catch up. On Wednesday morning, the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, or ECDC, said it would be increasing its presence on the ground. The ECDC said more of its experts would be deployed via the EU Health Task Force. And that concludes that article. Next up, Israeli strike in Gaza City kills new head of Hamas's military wing, by Rushdie Abulov and Ian Aikman. The commander of Hamas's military wing, Mohammed Odeh, has been killed in a strike in the Gaza Strip on Tuesday, days after his predecessor died in a similar attack. Dozens more were injured in the attack, which hit a residential building in one of Gaza City's busiest market areas, local medics and witnesses said. Israel's military and Shin Bet Security Service said buildings that served as a hideout for Odeh were targeted after his movements were tracked for several months. On Wednesday, Hamas confirmed that Odeh had been killed, along with his wife and two of his children. Despite the Israel-Hamas ceasefire agreed in October, violence in Gaza has continued on a near daily basis. Tuesday's strike hit the upper three floors of the Al-Khayali building in the center of Gaza City, where streets were busy with shoppers ahead of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. Rescue teams rushed to the scene of the strikes, but struggled to reach the upper floors because of the scale of the damage and congestion in the area. Witnesses said at least five missiles struck the building almost simultaneously from different directions. One resident said he heard the sound of a helicopter hovering overhead before the attack. Footage from the scene showed ambulances and civil defense crews searching through the damaged building as crowds gathered nearby. A statement from the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, and Shin Bet said, quote, as part of the joint operation by the IDF and Shin Bet to eliminate the terrorist Mohammed Odeh, several buildings in the heart of Gaza City that served as a hideout for him were attacked after months of intelligence surveillance in order to track his movements and the movements of his assistants in the organization, end quote. They added that they had also struck, quote, a nearby apartment belonging to a Hamas terrorist who raided on October 7th and was part of Odeh's circle of assistants, end quote, referring to the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel that triggered the war in Gaza. A local Hamas source later told the BBC on Tuesday that Odeh and his wife had been killed. Their family said one of Odeh's children died of his wounds in hospital on Wednesday morning, and a funeral was held after noon prayers at a mosque in Gaza City. Odeh had not been officially declared the new leader of the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades, but is understood to have been chosen just days ago. A statement from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said on Tuesday that Odeh was, quote, one of the architects of the October 7th massacre. Odeh was responsible for the murder, abduction, and wounding of many Israeli citizens and IDF soldiers, end quote. Odeh's predecessor as commander of the group's armed wing, Izz ad-Din al-Haddad, was killed in another Israeli airstrike earlier in May. That attack also targeted a residential building and killed at least three people, according to eyewitnesses and a local source. Israel has conducted regular strikes across Gaza since a ceasefire began on the 10th of October. Hamas has repeatedly accused Israel of breaching the terms of the ceasefire and attacking civilians. The Palestinian territory's Hamas-run health ministry has reported the killing of more than 900 people in Israeli strikes during the ceasefire. Israel's government maintains it has the license to target Hamas members and has in turn accused Hamas of breaching the ceasefire agreement by failing to disarm. The latter phases of a U.S.-led peace plan for Gaza have yet to come into force, with progress stalling since the U.S. and Israel started a war with Iran in February. The U.S. announced the start of the second phase of the plan in January, with governance of Gaza assumed by a transitional technocratic administration alongside the demilitarization and reconstruction of the territory. However, talks on disarmament remain deadlocked, while Hamas has since reactivated its police force and appears to be reasserting its authority. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said on Wednesday that Israel was committed to preventing Hamas from governing Gaza, quote, either civilly or militarily, end quote. He also said that what he called the, quote, plan for voluntary emigration from Gaza, end quote, would be implemented, quote, at the proper time and in the proper manner, end quote. In a statement, Netanyahu said Israel would, quote, continue to pursue anyone who took part in the October 7th massacre. Sooner or later, Israel will reach them all, end quote. About 1,200 people were killed in the Hamas-led attack, and 251 others were taken hostage. Israel responded by launching a massive military campaign in Gaza, which reduced much of the Palestinian territory to ruins and left many of its 2.1 million residents displaced. Israeli forces have killed more than 72,800 people in Gaza, according to its health ministry, whose figures the UN considers reliable. The latest Israeli attack on Gaza comes after 31 people were killed by Israeli strikes in Lebanon, where Netanyahu has vowed to step up military action against the armed group Hezbollah. Israel's military said its attacks targeted Hezbollah infrastructure and fighters. And that ends that article. The next article, 5 people found alive after week trapped in flooded Laos cave, by Patrick Jackson. Rescuers in Laos have found 5 villagers alive inside a flooded cave after they were trapped for a week following heavy rain and landslides. 2 other villagers who were with them are missing, Laotian and Thai rescue teams involved in the operation said. The 7 were part of a group of villagers from the central province of Zhezombung who had gone into the cave on Wednesday last week in search of gold deposits and wildlife, but could not get out as the cave's entrance was blocked. Footage shared by the rescuers showed cave divers crawling through narrow, muddy passageways that were almost completely flooded. Baunkam Luanglath of the Laotian Organization Rescue Volunteer for People told the Associated Press the search for the missing would continue. "I'm still shaking. Our team made it happen," he said in a voice message. The cave system, which extends deep underground, is also extremely narrow, with some chambers measuring only about 50 centimeters or 20 inches wide, rescuers say. "We've found 5 people alive and all safe," Rescue Volunteer for People said in a social media post. "There are still 2 people we are searching for," it added. Thai rescuer Kenkach Benkawang said on Facebook that the villagers had been found at 16:30 local time, or 9:30 GMT. Specialist rescue diver Mikko Pasi from Finland said earlier on Wednesday that rescuers needed to, quote, navigate hundreds of meters of constant restrictions, floodwaters, collapse hazards, and high risk of contaminated air quality, end quote, inside the cave, which he called a, quote unquote, abandoned gold mine. He estimated the 7 people were trapped around 300 meters, or 984 feet, from the exit. The villagers entered the cave about 120 kilometers, or 75 miles, north of the capital, Vientiane, last Wednesday, state media said. "The area is not owned by anybody," Laotian rescuer Bang, who requested one name be used for security reasons, told AFP News Agency. "Locals usually go there to dig holes and look for food," he added. Kenkach was part of the team that helped bring 12 young Thai boys and their football coach to safety after they were trapped for 2 weeks inside a flooded cave underneath a mountain in Thailand's Chiang Rai province in 2018. The extraordinary rescue involved more than 10,000 experts from around the world and drew intense global attention. Several films and documentaries have been made based on it, including the feature film 13 Lives and the documentary The Rescue. And that ends that article. Next, we have former member of German militant group jailed for armed robberies after decades on the run by Jessica Parker and Paul Kirby. A former member of the German militant group Red Army Faction, or RAF, has been jailed for 13 years for carrying out a string of armed robberies between 1999 and 2016. Daniela Klett, age 67, was finally caught in a flat in Berlin in 2024 after more than 30 years on the run. She went on trial last year. Her defense had called for her acquittal, but the court in Verden in Lower Saxony found her guilty on Wednesday of aggravated robbery, violating weapons laws, and other offenses over a 17-year period. The RAF, a violent anti-capitalist group, also known as the Bader-Meinhof Gang, was eventually disbanded after a campaign of murder, kidnapping, and bombing from the early 1970s to the early 1990s. The court found Klett had robbed supermarkets and armored vans along with two other former members of the RAF faction, Burkhard Garweg and Ernst Volker Staub, who have not yet been caught. Dozens of Klett's supporters booed the guilty verdict in court, chanting, quote-unquote, freedom for Daniela. According to Hans Jacob Schindler, head of the Counter-Extremism Project, she has become, quote, a kind of grandmother heroine for the extreme left in Berlin, end quote. Klett did not explicitly admit to being an RAF member during the trial, and Schindler told the BBC she would never face trial for terrorism allegations against her from that period because of the statute of limitations. However, she could still face a further trial, as federal prosecutors alleged she was complicit in three of the group's attacks. The trial focused on eight robberies across northern and western Germany, beginning in the city of Duisburg in July 1999, when masked attackers rammed a cash transport van and threatened the guards with guns and a grenade launcher before making off with a large sum of money. The final raid in June 2016 was on an armored transport van near the city of Braunschweig. The robbers seized almost 1.4 million euros, or 1.2 million pounds. Klett was not caught until February 2024 after a tip-off to police. She had been living on Sebastianstrasse in the Kreuzberg area of Berlin, a quiet street that was once divided by the Berlin Wall, under an assumed name and with a foreign passport. She was moved to Lower Saxony, where many of the robberies had taken place, to stand trial. Although Klett had been on the run for decades, prosecutors said she made no attempt to hide her identity. Hamza, one of her neighbors in Berlin, described how he would see her walking her dog in Berlin. She seemed friendly and would say hello, Hamza told the BBC, adding that he was shocked when he found out about her past. Klett had been using the name Claudia for years, but was tracked down by an investigative journalist using AI facial recognition software and matching an image from an old wanted poster to recent pictures from the internet. A police search uncovered weapons, ammunition, a replica rocket-propelled grenade, wigs, false IDs, gold, and 240,000 euros in cash. Klett's defense lawyers always argued there was no evidence she was involved in the robberies themselves, maintaining the only offense she had committed related to weapons in her flat. Although her membership of the RAF is beyond the statute of limitations, federal prosecutors have filed charges alleging Klett's involvement in three of the militant group's later attacks. They accuse her of complicity in a failed bombing in front of a Deutsche Bank building in 1990, a 1991 shooting which the U.S. Embassy in Bonn was hit by at least 57 bullets, and a 1993 bombing at a prison. Klett is alleged to have played a part in the third and final generation of the RAF, which killed 34 people between 1970 and 1991. Some of its most notorious crimes took place in 1977, when a federal prosecutor was shot dead and leading industrialist Hans Martin Schleyer was kidnapped and eventually killed. A decision on whether Klett will face a further trial rests with authorities in Frankfurt. there has been no trace of the two remaining RAF fugitives, Staub and Garwig. They could still be here. They could be abroad, Hans Jacob Schindler told the BBC. I guess they have learned the lesson not to put any pictures of themselves online, he added. And that concludes that article. Next, one killed and nine missing after chemical explosion at U.S. paper mill, by Max Matza. At least one person has been killed, and nine others are still missing after a major chemical explosion at a paper mill in Washington, authorities said. The explosion occurred at 7:15 PDT, or 15:15 GMT, at the Nippon Dynawave Packaging Facility in Longview, 130 miles, or 210 kilometers, south of Seattle. A further nine people have been injured in the spill, including eight employees and one firefighter, the Longview Fire Department said Tuesday evening, adding that the tank remains unstable. The explosion occurred due to a, quote, rupture of a tank containing white liquor, end quote, the company said in a statement. White liquor is a highly corrosive chemical used in the papermaking process. Recovery efforts remain complex due to ongoing safety concerns at the site. Currently, the tank remains unstable, creating hazardous conditions for emergency personnel, the fire department said in an evening update. They added, responders are continuing efforts to structurally reinforce and stabilize the site before additional recovery operations can safely proceed. While investigators originally believed the tank contained about 80,000 gallons or 300,000 liters of white liquor, officials later said it held approximately 900,000 gallons or 3,406,000 liters. About 90,000 gallons or 340,000 liters, quote, may remain inside the damaged tank, end quote, according to what the fire department said. Cowlitz Fire and Rescue Chief Scott Goldstein said during an earlier news conference that 10 people had been injured and transported to hospital. Nine of the people injured are employees at the factory, and one is a firefighter, Goldstein said at the time. Their injuries range from, quote, critical severe to minor, end quote, and include burn and inhalation injuries. The company statement said there were, quote unquote, multiple critical injuries. The scene is stable, the chief said, but the public should stay away from the area as firefighting efforts continue. He said the fire does not pose any threat to the larger community. The scene remains in the recovery phase as emergency responders continue operations, the Longview Fire Department said in a statement. No identifying information regarding injured or deceased individuals will be released at this time, pending notification of family members, the statement added. White liquor is, white liquor is an alkaline chemical containing sodium hydroxide and sodium sulfide. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson said state ecology workers have been sent to the site to assist local officials. I'm deeply saddened to hear that there have been fatalities, Ferguson said in a statement. My thoughts are with the workers and their families and with the first responders, he added. According to local media, the Nippon Dynawave Packaging Facility was also the scene of a major fire in July 2023, when piles of wood at the site burned for days. The plant makes tissues, printer paper, cups, plates, cartons, and other goods, according to CBS, the BBC's U.S. partner. It employs 1,000 people, according to the Washington State Department of Ecology. The explosion comes as officials in California say a chemical tank that threatened to explode has now been rendered safe. The tank in Orange County contains a plastic-making chemical, and its possible explosion led to an evacuation order affecting 50,000 people. Officials in Washington say no evacuation order is needed. And that concludes that article. The next article, hotel that refused to give tourist tap water acted lawfully, Italian court rules, by Harry Sokulich. Italy's highest court has ruled a five-star Dolomites hotel was acting lawfully when it refused to provide tap water to a tourist. The woman from Rome unsuccessfully argued that, quote, water is a natural resource and a universal human right, end quote, after a waiter only offered her 7 euro or 6 pounds bottled mineral water at the restaurant of the 5-star hotel Sassanger in Corvara during the 2019 ski season. The Italian Supreme Court denied her request for 2,700 euros to compensate her for emotional distress and economic damage, Italian media reports. Silvio Ballardi, the lawyer representing the hotel, told the Corriere Alto Adige newspaper that the court held that, quote, there is no obligation to supply tap water, end quote. The lawyer later told the BBC the case had been rejected first by a court in Rome, then by an appeals court, and now the Court of Cassation, where the judges ruled in the hotel's favor. The woman had claimed her consumer rights were violated when staff refused her request for tap water, saying it was a key part of the hotel's service, and likened it to, quote-unquote, finding a bed with sheets and, quote-unquote, soap in the bathroom. However, Silvio Ballardi said he had his colleagues argue that, quote, company policy is, like in many high-end establishments, to serve only bottled water at the table, which is sealed, end quote. He went on to say the woman claimed she had suffered damage, including financial and moral harm. This was rejected for lack of evidence. Supreme Court judges dismissed her claim, ruling that Italian laws and regulations did not mandate venues to provide tap water to guests and that the decision to serve it was up to individual venues. We also argued that if a person wanted running water, they could easily get that in the hotel, just not at the restaurant, Ballardi said. Licensed venues across England and Wales are legally required to serve free drinking water upon request. And that ends that article. Next we have Ghana Welcomes Pope's Apology Over Catholic Church's Role in Slavery by Thomas Nadi and Bisola Ruganga. Ghana has welcomed Pope Leo XIV's apology for the Catholic Church's historic role in slavery, describing it as a quote-unquote act of moral courage that was important in the global pursuit of quote-unquote truth, human dignity, and justice. The Pope issued the clearest apology yet for the Church's involvement in legitimizing slavery and its delay in condemning it for centuries. The apology was published on Monday in the Pope's first major teaching document of his papacy, which also focused on the dangers of artificial intelligence, or AI. Ghana was a major hub for the transatlantic slave trade when millions of people were captured and loaded onto ships, never to return home. Between the 16th and 19th centuries, 12 to 15 million Africans were shipped to the Caribbean, with about 2 million dying during the journey. Ghana has long been leading efforts for compensation and apologies from Western nations for the slave trade. The West African nation's government said the Pope's recognition of the painful past was an important step toward healing, reconciliation, and a just society. The apology reinforces the growing global understanding that confronting historical injustices demands truth-telling and moral responsibility as essential foundations for justice and reconciliation, its statement, released late on Tuesday, said. The Pope's apology was delivered in what is known as an encyclical, technically a letter to Catholic bishops, but which over recent decades have been how a pontiff passes on messages to the world. In the papal letter titled Magnifica Humanitas, or Magnificent Humanity, Pope Leo sincerely asked for a pardon in the name of the Church, adding that it was, quote, impossible not to feel deep sorrow when contemplating the immense suffering and humiliation endured by so many, end quote. Leo said Church authorities had at times responded to requests of rulers by, quote, regulating and legitimizing forms of subjugation, including the enslavement of non-Christians, end quote. He also acknowledged that earlier in the Middle Ages, ecclesiastical institutions had their own slaves. This constitutes a wound in Christian memory, he said of the Church's record. In April, Pope Leo completed a 11-day formation of Africa, his first visit to the continent as pontiff, and where he made several forthright remarks, including lashing out at foreigners who exploit Africa's wealth for profit. Ghana said the Pope's acknowledgement of the quote-unquote painful history was significant. At a time the world was having a deeper reflection, that's in quotes, quote-unquote deeper reflection, on the effects of slavery and colonialism. The country successfully pushed for a UN resolution in March, which recognized the enslavement of Africans as the quote-unquote gravest crime against humanity. Submitted by Ghana's President John Mahama and backed by the African Union, it aims to provide a pathway to healing and the payment of reparations. It also seeks to address the enduring consequences of slavery, like inequality and racial discrimination. Ghana, which still has some of the forts that were used for holding captives under inhumane conditions as they waited to be shipped to the Americas by European powers, is due to host a conference in June to discuss the next steps following the adoption of the UN resolution. On Tuesday, Human Rights Watch said the Pope's apology marked an important step, but stressed apologies alone were not enough and that real reparative justice needed to go further. Religious institutions, along with states and corporations that benefited from slavery, should, quote-unquote, reckon seriously with their histories and take part in reparative efforts, the rights group added. And that concludes that article. Next up, MAGA candidates win in Texas primary may also help Democrats in Senate battle, by Anthony Zurcher. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton easily defeated Senator John Cornyn in a Republican runoff primary on Tuesday night. While the outcome had been expected for weeks, it marks a stunning defeat for an incumbent who served in Congress for 23 years, including 12 years as a high-ranking member of the Senate Republican leadership team. The bruising contest set a record for the most expensive Senate primary campaign in U.S. history. It also sets up what will be a closely watched contest in November's general election between Paxton and his Democratic opponent, State Legislator James Tallarico. The outcome of that race will help determine whether Democrats can win back control of the U.S. Senate for the final 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency. Many Democrats have viewed Paxton as the weaker of the two candidates and relish what they believe is an opportunity to flip a Senate seat in a state with a long history of electing Republicans. Seemingly confident of his impending primary victory, Paxton, age 62, has already begun focusing on November's general election contest, airing television advertising over the past week attacking his opponent as a left-wing extremist. Polls have indicated a tight race in a state that hasn't elected a Democrat to the Senate since 1988. It's been 46 years since at least two incumbent senators were felled by voters in their own party in the same election cycle. Just 10 days ago, Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy failed to even reach his party's runoff primary, finishing behind two Republican challengers, the political equivalent of lightning striking in the same spot twice. Both Cornyn and Cassidy faced off against candidates endorsed by President Donald Trump. But that's where the similarities largely end. Unlike Cassidy, who voted to convict Trump during his 2021 Senate impeachment trial, Cornyn was a party loyalist who touted his ties to the president. While he was slow to endorse Trump's 2024 re-election bid, he faithfully towed the Republican line throughout his time in the Senate. In the first round of balloting in March, he finished slightly ahead of Paxton. So again, in the first round of balloting in March, he finished slightly ahead of Paxton, 42.5% to 40.8%, but short of the 50% necessary to avoid a runoff. The day after that vote, it appeared that Trump might endorse Cornyn, a popular figure among Senate Republicans due to his prolific fundraising and prior leadership in the chamber. That endorsement never came, however. Paxton, while beset with personal and political scandals over the years, was a favorite among Trump's populist base in Texas. He campaigned against the 74-year-old Cornyn as too old, too timid, too aligned with the political establishment, and too out of touch with Texas conservatives. Last week, after it appeared increasingly likely that Paxton would defeat Cornyn, despite being outspent by a 9-1 margin, Trump endorsed the challenger. Trump has accused Cornyn of being, quote-unquote, very disloyal to him on social media, arguing he did not fight hard enough to save Trump's voting reform legislation. In a post on his social media site Truth Social after Paxton's win, Trump congratulated Paxton and said he would, quote, become a fantastic common sense senator, end quote. He also congratulated Cornyn, quote, for having run a strong and powerful race, but more importantly, having had a truly great career. John will remain my friend for a long time to come, end quote, Trump said. Paxton's victory might be characterized as another example of the strength of Trump's endorsement. Trump has seen several Republicans who he endorsed go on to beat his critics in primaries, including Cassidy in Louisiana and Representative Thomas Massie in Kentucky. But this time, the timing suggests it is a case of Trump following his base, which at least in Texas is still hungry for firebrand populist conservatives and wary of longtime Washington politicians. If the Cassidy defeat showed Trump still can sway Republican voters, the Texas matchup hints that the impulses motivating Trump's base can at times be larger than and distinct from him. While the Republican Senate runoff was the most closely watched contest in Texas on Tuesday, there were several other notable contests on the ballot. In the race for the Republican nomination to replace Paxton as Attorney General, Congressman Chip Roy, a small government conservative who sometimes drew Trump's ire for voting against his party in the House, was defeated by State Senator Mays Middleton. Unlike the Senate primary, however, Trump didn't offer his endorsement, although he had called for Roy to be challenged for his congressional seat in 2023. Trump's endorsement power was on display farther down the Republican side of the ballot, however. In the solidly conservative 9th District, Trump-backed Army veteran Alex Mueller defeated State Representative Briscoe Cain, who had been endorsed by Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott. And in the 35th, Trump's Carlos de la Cruz prevailed over Abbott's John Lujan. In the runoff for the Democratic nomination in the 35th House District, which stretches southeast from the outskirts of San Antonio, Sheriff's Deputy Johnny Garcia defeated sex therapist Maureen Galindo. With Garcia's victory, the Democrats avoided nominating a divisive candidate in a congressional district that, while tilting towards Republicans, could be winnable for their party. Galindo, a little-known candidate, became a source of national controversy for suggesting that American Zionists should be held in immigration detention camps. Several other Democratic runoff contests pitted current and former members of Congress against each other, a reflection of the scramble created after the Republican-controlled state legislature redrew congressional lines last year to net more House seats for its party. In the Houston-centered 18th District, 38-year-old one-term Congressman Christian Menefee defeated 78-year-old Al Green, who had served in the House since 2005. Green built a reputation as a liberal firebrand. He was removed from Trump's past two congressional addresses for protesting and regularly introduced articles of impeachment against Republican presidents. Green was targeted by Fairshake, a cryptocurrency-backed group which spent approximately $6 million to oust the longtime congressman who had been a critic of the industry. In the 33rd District near Dallas, former Congressman Colin Allred, the Democratic nominee for Senate in 2024, defeated current Congresswoman Julie Johnson. It was a measure of revenge for Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, who was defeated by Tallarico for the Democratic Senate nomination in March. She had backed Allred, while Johnson was Tallarico's choice. Democrats may be encouraged by the Paxton victory, sensing that his past scandals make him a more vulnerable opponent than the deep-pocketed Cornyn. But given that Texas has long been considered reliably Republican territory, they will have to quickly pull together if Tallarico hopes to win in November. And that ends that article. Next we have South Korea detains dissident who fled China in rubber boat by Kelly Inge. A Chinese dissident who fled his country on a rubber boat has been detained in South Korea after spending hours at sea. Dong Guangping, a former police officer and human rights activist, was found in Korean waters on Monday night. South Korea's Coast Guard told the BBC that Dong is under investigation for suspected immigration violations and his case will be referred to prosecutors. The 68-year-old had been jailed in China several times for his activism, such as taking part in events to commemorate the Tiananmen Square crackdown. Dong had escaped China at least three times previously, but was sent back each time. When asked about Monday's incident, China's Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said she had not been aware of the case. Dong had set out from Weifang, a city in the central Shandong province, in a rubber boat with an engine, according to Canada-based activist Sheng Zhu, who posted on X saying she had spoken to Dong after he reached South Korea. He had told her that he had spent more than 30 hours at sea and was, quote-unquote, fainting from exhaustion by the time he reached the waters off Tai'in, a county on South Korea's western coast. South Korea's Coast Guard said they rescued him after receiving a report from a fishing boat that had spotted Dong. Dong had previously discussed his escape plan with Sheng Zhu, she said, but she had told him it would be too dangerous. He ended up really doing it. Dong Guangping is too tenacious, too brave, she said, adding that he had planned his escape with, quote, meticulous checks and preparation, end quote. Human Rights in China, or HRIC, NGO based in New York, has urged Seoul to, quote, uphold humanitarian principles and international human rights obligations, end quote, by not handing Dong over to China, where he, quote, faces a grave risk of persecution and torture, end quote. It also called on Korean authorities to allow Dong to seek political asylum or help facilitate a safe passage to Canada, where his family members live. That a man nearing 70 years old was driven across open seas in a small inflatable boat is itself a devastating indictment of China's human rights situation, HRIC said. Multiple escapes. In 1999, Dong was fired from the police force after he signed a petition to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the brutal Tiananmen crackdown on pro-democracy protesters. Then, in 2001, he was imprisoned for 3 years for, quote-unquote, inciting subversion of state power. He was jailed again in 2014 for participating in another Tiananmen commemoration event, according to Amnesty International. He first escaped China in October 2015 when he traveled to Bangkok with his wife and daughter, where they were granted refugee status by the United Nations and approved for resettlement in Canada. But days before they were scheduled to leave for Canada, Thai authorities deported Dong to China, along with another dissident who had also been given refugee status. The incident triggered fierce criticism from the UN. Dong was eventually jailed for, quote-unquote, inciting subversion and, quote-unquote, crossing the national border illegally. His second escape attempt took place in 2019, when he swam from Shishi City in Fujian province towards Kinmen, a small Taiwanese island. But Dong was picked up by a Chinese fisherman who handed him to police. Then, in 2020, Dong managed to flee China and entered Vietnam. He lived in hiding for 2 years in Hanoi, but was eventually detained by Vietnamese police and deported back home. He was jailed for 11 months for crossing national borders illegally and released in October 2023. Dong is not the first Chinese dissident to flee across the sea to South Korea. In 2023, another Chinese activist, Kwon Pyong, fled to South Korea on a jet ski. He was initially detained on immigration charges, but later resettled in the U.S. And that ends that article. Next up, NASA unveils next steps to build permanent moon base by Georgina Renard. NASA has released details of robotic landers, hopping drones, and vehicles it aims to send to the moon as part of U.S. plans to build a lunar base. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos' space company, Blue Origin, is one of several companies picked to build the machines. The U.S. wants to land Americans back on the moon before President Donald Trump leaves office in 2029. But NASA is competing with China to return humans to the lunar surface, meaning the space agency is under pressure to appear to be winning the new space race. China is forging ahead with its own plans to land humans on the moon by 2030. On Monday, it launched its Shenzhou 23 spacecraft, sending a crew of astronauts to the country's Tiangong space station. In March, NASA announced a $20 billion program to construct a permanent base powered by nuclear and solar energy at the moon's south pole by 2032. NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman said on Tuesday that the announcements mean the U.S. will, quote-unquote, never give up the moon again. A base would allow the U.S. to carry out scientific experiments, potentially mine valuable resources, and travel to Mars more easily. But most experts agree that NASA's timeline is unrealistic. Despite the U.S.'s success in sending four astronauts around the moon in its Artemis II mission in April, some scientists believe China is likely to be the next country to land humans on the lunar surface. It would not surprise me at all if China gets there first, Dr. Simon Barber, lunar scientist at Open University, told BBC News, citing NASA's setbacks in securing a craft that can land humans on the moon. NASA's Ignition Moon Base program has three phases. Before humans travel there, the space agency wants to send robotic landers and hopping drones to explore and map the moon's challenging terrain. Delivery vehicles would also be taken that could drive astronauts over the lunar surface and carry communications and scientific instruments. On Tuesday, NASA said companies including Blue Origin, Intuitive Machines, and Astrobotic have been awarded the contracts to build the machines. NASA wants Blue Origin's lunar lander, called Endurance, to be able to carry out precise landings, as well as autonomous navigation and control. Astrobotic's Griffin 1 lander is expected to land at Nobel Crater near the South Pole. The machines will also deliver scientific instruments for NASA, including high-resolution cameras and tools that use reflected laser light to help the craft land. This robotic exploration should last until 2029, with 25 launches and 4 metric tons of cargo landed on the moon, Carlos Garcia Galan, Moon Base Program Executive, said on Tuesday. Next, NASA wants to build nuclear and solar power facilities on the moon, including fission reactors. By 2032, the space agency wants humans to be able to live on the moon in quote-unquote semi-permanent housing. Rovers would also enable astronauts to travel long distance across the rocky surface. The moon's south pole is particularly appealing because frozen water could be used for drinking water or to produce oxygen. However, NASA's plans rely on a spacecraft being ready that can safely transport humans to the moon. Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, is contracted to build a craft called Starship Human Landing System, but it has faced numerous setbacks and delays. The limiting step is getting the astronauts down onto the surface, explains lunar scientist Simon Barber. It sounds to me like NASA feels they're in a position where they have to start saying they've got plans. So I think there's a lot of political drive behind this, Barber added. And that concludes that article. Next, YouTuber arrested for allegedly using AI to defame Korean actor, by Ko Yu. South Korean authorities have arrested a YouTuber who allegedly made defamatory claims about actor Kim Soo-hyun, fueling a scandal that halted the A-lister's career. Police and prosecutors allege that Kim Se-woo, who runs the popular YouTube channel Hover Lab, had manipulated evidence to falsely claim that Kim Soo-hyun had dated an actress while she was a minor, allegations that the actor has always denied. The Seoul Central District Court granted an arrest warrant for the YouTuber on Tuesday, citing concerns that he might destroy evidence or flee. In a statement on Wednesday, Kim Soo-hyun's agency said that the quote-unquote truth has been proven. In a statement, they also said the investigation confirmed that all suspicions and evidence raised by Hover Lab against Kim Soo-hyun were unfounded. And they also thanked the supporters who had stood by the actor. Speaking to reporters outside the court on Tuesday, ahead of the court's decision, YouTuber Kim Se-yu denied the charges and said the warrant, quote, did not even properly organize the basic facts, end quote. He said he would lodge complaints against the police and prosecutors who requested his arrest. The allegations against Kim Soo-hyun surfaced last year shortly after actress Kim Se-ron killed herself at the age of 24. Months after her death, the Hover Lab channel, which has nearly a million subscribers, posted a voice recording in which the actress could be heard saying she had been dating Kim Soo-hyun since she was in middle school. Police say that the voice recording was generated by AI. They also alleged that the YouTuber had manipulated screenshots of text messages sent from the actress's phone to make it look like she had been texting Kim Soo-hyun. Hover Lab is considered a controversial channel in South Korea and frequently posts commentary on politics and entertainment. It is also a popular channel for celebrity gossip. The allegations against Kim Soo-hyun shocked South Korea, where he is the star of multiple hit TV shows and appears in advertisements across the country. The claims made on Hover Lab, quote, collapsed Kim Soo-hyun's social base and his economic activities across the board and destroyed the basis for his professional survival, end quote, according to a police filing reported by news outlet Jung Ang Ilbo. Police also say the actor is, quote-unquote, still receiving psychiatric treatment. The actor has not made official public appearances since a tearful press conference in March 2025, where he said that he had dated Kim Se-ron for a year, but only when she was an adult. I can't admit to something I didn't do, he said. That month, he filed criminal complaints and lawsuits against the YouTuber and the actress's family for making false accusations. Kim Soo-hyun's press conference was mentioned in the statement by the actor's agency on Wednesday. At a press conference a year ago, Kim Soo-hyun promised, I won't ask you to believe me, I will definitely prove myself. This past year has been solely dedicated to keeping that promise. End quote. And that was according to the statement. And that ends that article. Next up, can EU find a Russia whisperer to mediate an end to war in Ukraine? By Sarah Rainsford. Ukraine is urging the EU to help negotiate an end to the war with Russia, a topic that will be discussed in detail at an informal meeting of European foreign ministers in Cyprus. The EU is actively reconsidering re-engagement with Moscow over Ukraine as U.S. efforts to mediate have ground to a halt and Russia steps up its deadly strikes. Now, Ukraine's foreign minister has told the BBC that Kiev is keen to introduce some quote-unquote new dynamics into the negotiation process. We need to move to a new format of talks with the Russian side, Andriy Sybiha said in a recent call, suggesting, quote, more active participation by the European side, end quote. Among the candidates rumored for the role of envoy are both former German Chancellor Angela Merkel and ex-Prime Minister of Italy Mario Draghi, but Sybiha wouldn't be drawn on any names. A spokesperson for Draghi told the BBC he, quote, prefers not to comment at this stage, end quote. This weekend, Finnish President Alexander Stubb said he, quote, probably couldn't answer in the negative, end quote, if he were offered the task, but only after Russia agreed to a ceasefire. There is no hint of that. Over the weekend, Kiev was pummeled with missiles and drones in one of the most intense attacks of the war so far, and Moscow has since threatened, quote-unquote, systematic strikes on the city, warning foreigners to leave and locals to be aware. Even as it escalates its aggression, Russia is accusing the EU of encouraging Kiev militarily and so undermining U.S. peace efforts. So it's difficult to see it engaging with the Europeans in any meaningful way. Russia prefers to talk to the U.S., partly for reasons of status and partly because President Donald Trump's envoys have been deeply unchallenging, pressuring Kiev far more than Moscow. Their approach has failed, and last week Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. was not interested in hosting, quote, an endless cycle of meetings that lead to nothing, end quote. He has since clarified that the U.S. remains ready to mediate, quote-unquote, if that opportunity presents itself. Now the EU is looking to join the effort and ensure that any deal, if ever done, is the best for both Ukraine and European security. Vladimir Putin claims he is open to the idea as long as whoever is appointed, quote, has not said all sorts of nasty things about us, end quote. His own suggestion for EU envoy, though, was German ex-chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, a close ally of Moscow and longtime lobbyist for its interests. The EU's foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, rejected the idea immediately. Schroeder, she said, would be, quote-unquote, sitting on both sides of the table. The two-day gathering that opens in Cyprus on Wednesday will allow ministers to set out their country's stalls with more freedom than a formal summit. Since Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022, most have pursued a policy of isolation and sanctions, and not all agree on the wisdom of initiating even limited contacts. Some, like Sweden and Lithuania, see Russia as squeezed now and want the pressure increased, not eased. Others, like Italy, argue that it's unwise to stay on the sidelines any longer. In March, Kallas circulated some starting points for discussion, described by one EU official as, quote-unquote, food for thought. Her goal is to formulate a joint EU position regarding Russia and set any red lines before initiating contact. While the idea of appointing an envoy, perhaps even a group of them, will be floated in Cyprus, serious discussion would only happen at the level of EU leaders, potentially at their summit next month. Meanwhile, Ukraine wants to, quote-unquote, break the deadlock and is pushing for progress, the EU official said. This must not become a prolonged process focused only on discussions about who should represent, how many people, and what format. No, this must happen quickly, Sibhia warned. In Kiev, analyst Yaroslav Smovzev believes that engaging with Moscow is, quote-unquote, doomed unless the EU comes from a position of strength. There is a sense that Europe has somewhat lost its sense of agency in international affairs, especially regarding such an important large-scale war in Europe, says Smov from the Adastra think tank. But if Europe wants to act as an independent and neutral intermediary, it will not yield any results, just like the U.S. did not achieve any success, he said, arguing that Russia needs to, quote-unquote, be intimidated. He also added, so far, Europe's response to Russia's behavior in its own territory has been somewhat unconvincing. As the EU talks about talks, Ukraine has been increasing the pressure on its neighbor itself, with repeated deep strikes on Russian oil export facilities. It calls them its, quote-unquote, long-range sanctions, and Moscow's latest large-scale attacks on Ukraine show that it's rattled. That doesn't mean serious negotiations for peace are around the corner. There are no signals that Russia wants to end this war, MP Ahor Chernov from Ukraine's ruling Servants of the People Party says. But as U.S. interest in pursuing that goal has waned, he believes, quote, new energy can be brought to this process, end quote, from Europe. They will represent the EU, which clearly understands the threat from Russia, the MP says. And that concludes that article, and that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening.